at Katra Podcast Conversations for the curious, essential knowledge. Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're digging into a really important moment of, well, historical rethinking. We're moving past some of those tired, honestly damaging ideas about African history.
We are. We're looking at Basil Davidson's major 1969 book, The African Genius. And Davidson's goal here, it was huge. Basically, to provide a solid, clear pushback against that old colonial story.
Right, the one that just dismissed pre-colonial Africa. Like, yeah. No real history, no organized societies, no complex culture.
Exactly that. He wanted to show that was just plain wrong.
The scale of that is just, yeah. Wow. So for you listening now, maybe wondering about current events, why does this book from decades ago about history way back then, why is it still so important?
Because you really can't grasp the present without it. I mean, think about modern Africa. Mm. Some of the political instability, conflicts that stem from those, frankly, random colonial borders.
Yeah.
The identity issues many nations are still working through. A lot of those challenges, they're rooted in the disruption, often violent disruption, of systems that were working centuries ago. So this isn't just old history. It's about recovery, about understanding the context for what's happening right now.
It sounds less like writing history and more like, I don't know, intellectual repair work. Let's talk about the person behind it. Basil Davidson, 1914 to 2010. You said he wasn't a typical academic, which feels important.
Absolutely. He was kind of an outsider, started as a journalist, even worked in British intelligence during the war. He didn't come up through the usual, often very Eurocentric university system. And that probably gave him a certain freedom.
Freedom to see things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And his background as a reporter, an observer, how did that shape his writing? I gather he spent a lot of time actually in Africa talking with nationalist leaders as countries were becoming independent.
That's the key thing, that direct experience. He wasn't theorizing from an office somewhere. He was there watching this massive transition unfold. It gave him this deep anti-colonial viewpoint. He wasn't just reporting. He became this passionate advocate, really focused on listening to African perspectives, understanding their systems on their own terms.
So this book and his earlier one, The Lost Cities of Africa, it was part of this bigger project then.
Yes, a sustained effort to make the West really face up to the continent's rich, complex past. He was determined.
Okay, let's get to the core idea of the African genius. What's the main argument he's driving home?
Well, it's right there in the title, isn't it? That pre-colonial African societies had this inherent genius. And this genius wasn't always about, say, building huge stone monuments, but about creating stable, meaningful communities. They had these unique, highly developed ways of governing, of making laws, of understanding the world.
Publishing this in 1969, just as many African nations were gaining independence. That must have felt quite radical, like a statement. What was he trying to achieve at that specific moment?
Oh, it was definitely a deliberate move, a corrective. He wanted to tear down those racist, sort of paternalistic ideas that had been used to justify colonialism for so long. He's basically saying, stop judging these societies by European standards.
Right. Look at them on their own terms.
Exactly. He wants to take us inside their world, understand their mental furniture, as he calls it, how they thought. The book starts with belief systems, then moves out to politics, and finally looks at the disruption from outside forces like the slave trade and colonialism.
That structure makes sense. Start with the foundation belief.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Davidson identify as really fundamental to the African worldview that maybe Western perspectives often miss?
The big one is holism. You know, this Western idea that religion and everyday life, the secular, are separate things. That just didn't apply in the same way. For many traditional African societies, they were completely intertwined.
How so?
The universe was seen as having this vital life force, this energy, and the whole point of politics, law, society itself, was basically to keep things in balance, both cosmically and socially.
Okay, if the goal is balance, who keeps things in check?
Yeah.
Davidson talks a lot about the ancestors. How are they different from just, you know, remembering historical figures?
It's much more than memory. The ancestors aren't just gone. They're seen as active, powerful members of the community right now. They're the guardians of morality, of tradition. They give real weight to customs and laws. Kinship isn't just about family trees. It's this sacred living network that holds society together.
And this is where Davidson really pushes against Western views,
right.
His take on witchcraft. We tend to see it as well, irrational superstition.
Yeah.
But he says it actually functions as a social mechanism.
It's a really fascinating argument about internal logic. Witchcraft, in the way he describes it, it does provide an explanation when bad things happen, drought, illness, you name it. It answers that why me question.
Okay.
But more than that, accusations of witchcraft often surface when there are hidden tensions simmering in the community, envy, disputes, conflicts that aren't being addressed openly.
So investigating a witchcraft accusation isn't just about punishment. It's a way for the community to diagnose its own problems,
yeah,
to bring hidden issues out and restore that balance you mentioned. That implies a really coherent social system.
Precisely. The ultimate aim is almost always restoring harmony. And this spiritual foundation, this focus on balance, directly shaped how they organized power.
Okay, so if the inner world is about balance, how does that play out in governing? Davidson argues against the idea that the only real government is a centralized European-style state, right?
Right. He shows this huge variety of political forms. Even in the big, well-known kingdoms like Asante or the Yoruba states, the main job of government was often about building consensus, mediating disputes, keeping the peace, not just giving orders from the top.
What about concepts like divine kingship? That sounds pretty top-down, even autocratic.
It sounds that way to us, but Davidson digs into the details. The king's power, even if seen as divine, was almost always conditional. Yes, he embodied the kingdom's well-being and linked to the cosmos, but he was held in check by powerful councils, by deeply ingrained traditions, by customary laws. If things went badly wrong for the kingdom, or if the king really overstepped, he could actually be removed, often through ritual means. He wasn't an owner, he was more like a steward. Accountable to the people and crucially to the ancestors, that's very different from the idea of absolute monarchy that developed in Europe.
Okay, but the real eye-opener, the core of this African genius in politics, seems to be the stateless societies.
Yeah.
How on earth does a large group of people function without any central government at all?
This is where Davidson thinks the real political innovation lies. Societies like the Igbo in what's now Nigeria or the Tulenzi in Ghana, these were large, successful, often wealthy societies, but no king, no central bureaucracy.
So how did anything get done? How do they settle arguments or organize things?
Through incredibly sophisticated, decentralized systems. Power wasn't concentrated, it was spread out. You had strong lineage groups, clan structures, important associations based on age, like age grades. Decisions weren't handed down, they emerged from discussion, often guided by councils of elders who interpreted customary law.
It proves order is possible without a single boss, essentially.
Exactly. Stability came from this delicate balance of power shared across different groups. It completely challenges that default Western assumption that you need centralization for things to work.
But this intricate system eventually collided with the outside world. Let's talk about the impact of the Atlantic slave trade. Davidson's view is pretty stark, isn't it?
Devastatingly so. He doesn't just call it a human tragedy, which of course it was. He calls it a political cancer. Because it didn't just steal people. It burrowed deep into the political systems themselves. The European demand for enslaved people fundamentally poisoned African governance. It incentivized violence and broke down trust.
It sounds like it created this kind of dark feedback loop.
That's a good way to put it. African rulers or warlords, often needing European guns to defend themselves or expand power, started raiding neighbors specifically to get captives to trade. This fed a cycle of violence that tore apart existing alliances, wrecked local economies,
and corrupted their own systems.
Yes, that was maybe the most corrosive part. Traditional justice systems, which might have focused on reconciliation or fair punishment, got twisted. Judgments could become just another way to produce people to sell into slavery.
A complete distortion. And then, following that damage, came colonialism itself, which sort of finished the job of dismantling things.
Pretty much. Colonial powers arrived and drew lines on maps, borders that made no sense in terms of who actually lived where or existing political structures. Then, crucially, they dismantled the indigenous ways of governing, even when they used indirect rule through local chiefs.
That wasn't really respecting tradition, was it?
No. It stripped those chiefs of their real traditional legitimacy, the authority that came from the people and the ancestors, and turned them into little more than local administrators for the colonial regime. This created this deep crisis of institutions, a fragmentation of political identity that you can still see the echoes of today.
Okay, let's pull back from the historical detail for a moment and think about the big themes. What are the core messages from Davidson that really stick with you, that feel relevant now?
I think there are three big ones we can pull out. First, the primacy of social cohesion. Almost everything in traditional African societies, kinship rules, ancestor veneration, even how they handled conflict, it was ultimately aimed at keeping the community together, ensuring collective survival. The group often came before individual ambition.
That really lands differently in our world today, which is so focused on the individual, doesn't it? It makes you wonder what we lose when we prioritize personal success above community well-being.
It does. The second theme is power as a trust, not a right. We touched on this with the kings. Authority wasn't owned. It was granted conditionally by the community and the ancestors. The ruler was accountable. That's a powerful model for leadership today, whether you're talking politics or even running a company. Accountability is key.
Power held in trust. I like that. And the third.
It loops back to the beginning, the holism of African thought, the seamless weaving together of the spiritual, the political, the social. Life wasn't chopped up into separate boxes. There's a lesson there about coherence, maybe. We often struggle with juggling different parts of our lives, work, family, values. Davidson shows societies built on a deeply integrated worldview.
It's a different way of defining success, too, isn't it? He argued that civilization shouldn't just be measured by big buildings, but by the ability to create humane, functioning communities that last.
Exactly. It's about the resilience of the social fabric.
That focus on the ideas and systems comes through so strongly. Let's think about some of the key statements or the essence of them that really capture the book's impact.
Well, take that point on holism. Davidson basically says, to understand the politics, you first have to understand the religion. They were never separate. That's the mental shift required, right? You have to drop the Western separation of church and state to get it.
Yeah, definitely. And then there's his point about the stateless societies, the political genius there. Many African peoples proved government is possible without the state. Order came not from a king's commands, but from a delicate balance of power.
That's such a direct challenge to how we usually think about political history, isn't it? It really champions these decentralized, consensus-based ways of organizing.
And finally, that stark image of the slave trade's impact. The Atlantic slave trade was a political cancer, rewarding violence, betraying trust, corroding institutions from within. It focuses right on the lasting internal damage.
Yeah, it helps you see how that internal decay created vulnerabilities that colonialism later exploited. It wasn't just an external attack. It changed things from the inside out.
So for you listening and learner, how can we take these big historical ideas and actually use them, apply them somehow?
Well, application one is pretty fundamental. Challenging your own Eurocentrism. Use this book as a lens. When you encounter a different way of doing things, maybe a non-Western approach to education or law or community building, pause before assuming the Western way is automatically better or the only way. Really try to understand the internal logic first.
That feels essential, especially in a globalized world. And I think it connects to management or community work too, like application two, alternative governance models, learning about stateless societies, how they used consensus or age grades. That offers real ideas for running teams, committees, community groups today. Maybe less top-down instruction, more focus on finding genuine agreement and shared responsibility.
Exactly. Which leads naturally to application three, conflict resolution. Think about the African focus on restoring harmony, not just punishing wrongdoing. When you're mediating a dispute, say, at work or in a neighborhood group, can the goal be shifted? Not just figuring out who's wrong, but actually repairing the relationship, making sure the group can function well again. It's about fixing the break, not just assigning blame.
Repair over retribution. That's a powerful reframe. As we wrap up, what was the biggest thing you took away, or what surprised you most?
For me, it was that insight into decentralized power. I honestly assumed that once societies got large, you just needed a state. Seeing how peoples like the Igbo managed complex societies through these diffuse networks, clans, lineages, it just blew apart my assumptions about what's politically necessary. It makes you think about untapped structures in our own communities.
That's a great point. For me, it's the fundamental shift in perspective Davidson achieved. He really moved the historical focus. Instead of just telling the story of what was done to Africa, you know, the narrative of victimhood and external forces, he centered what Africa was doing. He highlighted the internal creativity, the genius for self-governance, the social resilience. He put African peoples back in the driver's seat of their own history as active agents, thinkers, builders, restoring that complexity and dignity. That's his lasting contribution, I think. His genius, maybe.
A truly perspective-shifting deep dive. Thanks for unpacking that.
My pleasure. Important stuff. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.